Welcome to Parents Perspective. Susan knew Philip was a tough kid to manage. His high arousal and sensory craving could send him into overdrive, and she knew he counted on her to read the signs and rescue him before it was too late. Family gatherings like Thanksgiving were bad enough, but birthday parties were impossible. Philip would run in circles, bumping into people and knocking over chairs. Susan knew he didn't mean to hurt anyone, but if she relaxed her vigilance, even a little, it always ended in disaster. Finally, she told Fred she didn't think Philip should go to any more parties. "I can't stand it. It's too exhausting." "I'll take him," Fred offered, but Susan refused. She knew Fred wouldn't stay on top of things the way she did. He'd let Philip get revved up, and it would be up to her to deal with the consequences. It was hardly worth it. She might as well take Philip herself. Not trusting Fred with birthday party duty, Susan missed an important chance to take a break and give Philip a different perspective. This is a brief excerpt from the book, When Labels Don't Fit, A New Approach to Raising a Challenging Child. From a parent's perspective, how can we help our challenging children to manage their day-to-day living and still keep our sanity? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest specializes in working with challenging children. Barbara Probst is a licensed clinical social worker specializing in difficult or different children and their families. She also teaches at Fordham University's Graduate School of Social Services. Her book, When the Labels Don't Fit, A New Approach to Raising a Challenging Child, offers a comprehensive and practical approach to raising such children. She herself is the mother of two teenagers. Welcome to Parents Perspective, Barbara.
Hi there. I'm thrilled to be here today.
What seems to be parents' greatest concern about challenging children, as you call them?
Well, you know, when parents would come to see me, I could feel how they were suffering and struggling, really, to find some kind of explanation that would help them figure out what was going on with their child. Because when a parent sees that their child is unhappy, unsuccessful, making life difficult for both the child and the parent, they want to help. They're searching for some explanation, some way to make sense out of all of this. And what I was finding was that the only system of explanation that they were offered was essentially a negative one. So that's really what led me to write the book, to try to find another framework for helping parents make sense of what was going on, to give them the peace of mind that their child would find a way to be successful later on.
Your book is titled When Labels Don't Fit. What makes these kids so hard to diagnose?
My book is not called Throw Out the Labels. The labels have their uses, which I can talk about. But really what I want to say is the label does not tell you everything that's important about your child. And in so many cases, the labels really don't fit. They're fundamentally negative, and they're inexact, and they leave out a lot of what matters about the child. When you hear someone say, my child is ADHD or my child is bipolar, I say to them, well, you'd never say my child is asthma or my child is diabetes. The fact that a child may struggle with attentional issues or struggle with moods or struggle with being depressed tells you something about that child, but it doesn't define who the kid is, and it doesn't really tell you what makes that child tick. So that's one of the things that's a problem with the label. The other problem is that they're really laundry lists. You go through, and they're checklists. And if you can check off enough of the behaviors, then voila, you have the label. But the difficulty is that it's very inconsistent. For one thing, there was a very interesting piece in the New York Times a couple of years ago that showed that approximately two-thirds of the kids who receive diagnoses of oppositional defiant also meet criteria for ADHD and also meet criteria for bipolar. So which label do you pick? It doesn't matter. What I'm suggesting in my book is that we pull the label apart, look at the specific traits, features, needs, struggles, quirks, difficulties, and zoom in to the level that's much more specific to the traits, which is the level at which you can actually intervene intelligently and helpfully. So I'll give you an example. If you have a child who's a perfectionist, which is a trait, P.S., that does not appear on the symptom list for any of these labels. But it's huge. It's been left out. I have no idea why, but it's certainly one of the things that causes a lot of difficulty. So you take a trait like perfectionism, a trait like a very fast tempo. Again, not on any symptom list. A trait like rigidity, poor adaptability, intense need for stimulation, intense need for regularity. These are traits. Where do they fit? Who knows? What matters is the trait that lies behind the behavior and how you can work with it. In 9 times out of 10, the problem is that one of these traits exists to a very high degree, is misunderstood, is not recognized, and the need is not being met. And that's where all the problems come from. So I'll give you an example. You take a kid who has a really instinctive, organic need to move and touch. That's how this kid interacts with the world. That's how this kid learns. The child is in school. What happens? Gets in trouble for moving and touching, gets a smiley face for sitting still and not touching. What message does the child get? Well, the way I am is no good. There's something wrong with how I instinctively want to be, and I can only be successful when I suppress my natural way of being. Now, I'm not suggesting that a child can run around, touch everything indiscriminately. It needs to be managed in healthy, pro-social ways. However, the fundamental message this kid gets is, I'm no good. And then we're surprised when that child later becomes defiant, hostile, anxious, depressed, withdrawn, and we spend a lot of energy addressing these secondary behaviors, which really came from a fundamental trait that was suppressed or misdirected. And it's so much more helpful, rather than saying, does this kid have ADHD? It doesn't matter. What matters is he has a need to use the body. So let's work with that in a healthy way. The other thing besides this zooming in is all the stuff the labels leave out. What does this child love, gravitate toward, enjoy? What are his strengths? What about his empathy, love of design, manual dexterity, love of music? All of these things that are so key to the child developing his or her individuality, authenticity, and happiness are not captured by these fundamentally negative labels.
We'll take a short break now and return to continue our discussion on raising challenging children.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Barbara Probst about when labels don't fit, raising challenging children.
You do actually label some kinds of temperaments, for example, traits, as you said.
Well, if by label you mean give words to, correct.
Yes.
What I do in the book is offer parents a questionnaire where they can identify which features are the most key, the most core for that kid. Mm-hmm. The difference between these temperamental traits and the diagnostic labels is very big, though, because traits are neither good nor bad. They are value-free. The same trait that can be a problem in one setting is a strength in another, or at one stage of life becomes a strength in another. And so they're really features rather than pathological disease disorder-based labels.
Sure. So do you offer parents some techniques for dealing with these different characteristics?
Oh, you bet. what I did in the book was put in, I think it's more than 60 specific strategies that you can use depending on the kind of kid you got. There could be a perfectly wonderful strategy that is totally inappropriate. So the first step for parents is to figure out what in his essence is my child really like. And then you can be proactive and use strategies that are going to make sense. I'll give another example. You have a child in the toy store. Meltdown, because the kid cannot pick a toy. One of these no good deed goes unpunished scenarios where you have, here's $20 to buy a toy, and you leave in tears. The child has nothing. You feel unappreciated. We've all been there. What happened? What went wrong? The way to understand what went wrong and then help to make it go right is to figure out what was behind the meltdown. One child may be the kind who's, again, a perfectionist, has such a specific idea of what he or she must have, nothing fits the bill. Another child has a very divergent, widespread way of looking, is taking in more than he can process, has no clue what he wants everything, and can't choose. These are two very different kinds of kids. The resultant behavior may look the same, but the intervention has to be different because the children are very different in their natures. So by knowing ahead of time, you can plan intelligently. So that's the difference with working with features as opposed to things that you think are wrong with your kid that you want to change or fix.
Are there certain kinds of responses to difficult behavior that seem to be productive for all kinds of children?
Absolutely. And I'm going to also go back. You know, when I say that I work with difficult or different children, I always put those words in quotation marks, right?
Yeah.
Because all kids are challenging at some point in some situations. So there's really not an us-them kind of demarcation. So absolutely. I think I could probably list four or five, I think, really key principles for parents. One, the most important, really, is show your child you get it. Your kid is in total distress because something didn't turn out the way he had in mind. The first thing we usually try to do is make it better, make it go away, make him not feel that way. In fact, the first thing we need to do is show that we get it. You really feel lousy that the movie was sold out. You're the kind of person who really has a hard time with changes of plan. You really don't like surprises. You're telling the kid, I get it. You're the kind of person, it's not that there's something wrong with you, but you're a particular type.
There was a wonderful doctor who has an idea of empathy with the child, where you actually get down on the floor child's level.
Absolutely.
And speak in a fairly dramatic way, mimicking what the child is saying. You don't want to do that. You are very angry. And evidently, it has terrific results.
It really does, because kids want to understand, first of all, that you get how they're feeling. And we may see a child as angry or upset, and we want to fix it. We don't want him to feel that way because we love him and we care. But you can't skip to step two without step one, which is really that joining. And let's say the child is having a fit because he's determined to put on his own shoes. He can't do it. You're already late. You want to just grab the shoes, put them on. But you have to stop and say, it's really important to you that you can master this. You're not a quitter. And I love that about you, and it's going to help you in your life. However, then you get to the however part, but you begin with that, I get it. And a piece of that, when I said you're not a quitter, has to do with the second principle, which is the reframing. We can say about a child, oh, she is so picky. But if we reframe it in the way we speak and think, she has strong views about what she likes. She's selective. I'll throw out a word like impulsive, and I'll say, reframe it. And parents will say, curious, inquisitive, responsive, lively. And they begin to see that it's a feature, and we get so used to thinking of it negatively, it doesn't have to be negative.
Well, especially when things come like you have a nice dinner that you've made and you've got company and you have your discriminating child discriminating against everything on his plate.
Sure. But to really empower both you and your child to understand that it's a feature. It can be managed. It can be worked with. But it's simply in itself a feature. So there's that reframing showing that you get it. Another principle, which I was talking about before, is taking a step back and looking at what's behind the behavior rather than trying to get it to stop. Otherwise, an analogy I use is we're spending all our time constantly mopping the floor instead of fixing the leaking roof or even realizing that the roof is leaking. Being proactive and being very concrete. Kids are super concrete. An example is when we say to a child, come in 5 minutes. Well, kids have no idea what 5 minutes means. All it means is, I don't have to listen to you right now. So instead, you say to the child, 3 more turns on the skateboard. It's a unit of experience that the kid knows what it means. Even better, how many more turns on the skateboard do you need? The child picks. If it's reasonable, okay. Then you're really getting yourself out of 90% of the power struggle in that situation. But getting back to the being proactive, just again an example. You have the kind of child who has a very, very rigid idea of what has to be. So you go to the ice cream store, the kid has a picture, I'm going to have mint chocolate chip with chocolate sprinkles. You get there, no mint chocolate chip or no sprinkles. And it's over. And you are desperately trying everything in your arsenal to make that child happy and quiet, offering other flavors, offering ice cream every day for the rest of his life, offering to go to A&P and get a gallon of ice cream. You know, none of it works because it wasn't what this particular child had in mind. Now, it's way too late. There is nothing to be done. But if you know through taking the questionnaire, through thinking about it, through sitting with your kid, I've got the kind of kid who cannot adapt on the spot, who has a picture. So what do? Proactively, for this type of child, before you leave the house, what ice cream do you plan to get today? What's your plan B if they don't have it?
Teach them that.
You have the child write down on an index card, strawberry, rainbow sprinkles. Put the index card in his pocket. So he owns it already. It's already in his mind and it's already been concretized. When you get to the ice cream store, if they don't have chocolate sprinkles, quick, pull out your card, rainbow sprinkles. And then it's already in the child's mind. It's not something you're trying to whip out to talk him out of his righteous misery. And once a child can have a plan B, plan C, D, and E are easy. It's that initial ability to be able to have a second choice. But for a child like that, it has to be done ahead of time in a very concrete way. And then it can be generalized to other situations through practice. Terrifically empowering. But that's an example of another core principle.
We'll take a short break now and we'll return to finish our discussion on raising challenging children.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Barbara Probst about when the labels don't fit, raising challenging children.
Parents listening who have children who are 2, 3, 4, 5,
yes,
who are not going to be able to write on the index card, who will have no interest in the index card, but who are going to have big-time meltdowns in that kind of situation. What do you do with that age child?
Yes, absolutely, and I'm glad you asked. The older the child, the more they are partnered. The younger the child, the more you do it. So you say to that child, You can still ask a 3-year-old, what flavor do you want? But you can write it down, or you can make a picture, or have the child make a pink circle and color it in for strawberry. You can translate it into the developmentally appropriate level. But the principle is the same. But thank you, because it definitely has to be adapted to developmental level. And P.S., those labels, those negative disorders, don't take developmental stage into account. But getting back to some of the principles, another one is to find the level at which your child can be successful. If clean up your room is impossible, put your shoes in the closet. Maybe the level where your child can experience success. Because we don't learn from our mistakes. We learn from our successes. Okay. You lower the bar. You start with what your kid can do. Your kid cannot wait while you're on the telephone. This is another thing many, many parents experience.
We all know that one.
Right. So to say to the child, I'll be off soon, is meaningless. You take a 3-minute egg timer. Quick, turn it upside down. I promise you, watch the sand. When the egg timer is done, I'll be all yours. If 3 minutes is too long, you do a 1 minute. You start at the level where the child can be successful, and you gradually raise the bar on that. You give your kids experiences. Another one, a child who has a tremendous need for control, for instance, you give a child something he can control. One of the techniques that I offer is called the magic coin. You give, again, we adjust it developmentally, but a kid who wants to have everything his way, you give him 3 or 1 or however many you want magic coins every day that he can trade in for something he can have his way so he can experience that. Now, it doesn't mean anything unhealthy, unsafe. It's the little stuff, but beginning to experience that. When I talk about kids needing experience of being successful, rather than putting a lot of attention when they do it wrong, give them a chance to do it right. And one technique in the book is rewind the tape. This is good for the little ones, too. Child walks in the door, throws everything on the floor. How many times have I told you to hang up your backpack and your coat? Why didn't you hang up your coat? None of these matters. You just say, stop, rewind the tape. Have the child literally pick the coat up off the floor, walk backwards to the front door, which is great fun, and redo it the right way. And then you say, that's it. Thanks. Great. And you can use it yourself. If you catch yourself responding in a way you wished you hadn't, you say, I better rewind the tape here. So modeling is another big one. But those are some of the principles that can be used with any trait, any child.
How is it significant for us to know ourselves in dealing with these kinds of children?
That is such an important question because, and I also tell parents, you take the temperament questionnaire for yourself to figure out your key features. And it's also interesting to take it for one another because the way I see myself may not be the way my child sees me. For instance, if a parent is somebody who is very spontaneous, let's go to the beach today, but has a child who gets very distressed when there's any change in plan, there's going to be a mismatch and there's going to be struggle and strife. So we can't expect our kids to do all the work. We as adults have more capacity, once we know what we're like, to be more self-reflective, flexible, and leaders, to do it first. So it's terribly important to understand our buttons, our triggers, what makes me tick. Absolutely important.
What should teachers know about these especially demanding sometimes kids?
Well, you know, it's so important that the teacher and the parent are really communicating. And if you as a parent have figured out, you know, I have the kind of kid who has a tremendous need for stimulation or movement or time or space, or regularity, or whatever it is, by communicating that, the teacher can begin to be proactive as well. The kid has a need to use the body. The teacher can help them find a healthy way of doing that before the problem happens. Mm-hmm. Because really, the more that the same principles are being used in two settings, the more the child can internalize and generalize. And it's very, very important. So again, it's really communication and what are the features? What does this kid need?
Barbara, we're going to have to close shortly. What resources would you recommend for adults who would like to research this topic further?
My website, which is www.whenthelabelsdontfit.com. And on my website, I have a lot of information about the book. There are video clips, audio clips, sample strategies, links to all sorts of stuff. The other thing I might want to offer is, in my experience, a lot of the children that I've worked with who are quirky, eccentric, outside the box, intense, extreme, are also very bright. And their intelligence, giftedness, interacts with these personality traits in particular ways that have not always been well understood in our educational system. So I would suggest there's a couple of great websites for kids like that. One is SENG, S-E-N-G, SENG Gifted. Another one is the 2E newsletter, Twice Exceptional. And there's another one, Visual Spatial, that talk about these kind of kids who, again, are very smart, but have really intense, unusual traits. So that might be helpful to parents as well.
Well, Barbara Probst, this has been a wonderful discussion and certainly a beginning for lots of parents who want to learn more about children who are challenging, interesting, exciting, and take a lot of knowledge and work. So thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Barbara Probst's book, When the Labels Don't Fit, A New Approach to Raising a Challenging Child. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 407 and tell us, if you can, what station you're tuning into.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from our listeners. Our sound engineer is Elizabeth Buckle. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.